From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. In late June, the first Saudi women to legally drive a car in the kingdom started their engines and took off down the road. The lifting of Saudi Arabia's ban on female drivers was a step forward for women, but it's just one of a number of recent steps for women's rights in the Arab world. Countries like Tunisia, Jordan, and Lebanon have passed laws ending legal loopholes that let rapists off the hook for marrying their victim. Some countries have rolled back exemptions for those who commit so-called honor killings of female family members. Other Arab states have changed divorce and inheritance laws to give women more rights. Still, many women's rights advocates are only cautiously optimistic. In many countries, laws aimed at helping women aren't enforced. War in Syria and Yemen has left much of their populations just trying to survive, nor are public attitudes towards women's rights necessarily becoming more progressive. A major survey by the organization Promundo found that young men in Egypt, Morocco, and Palestine are just as conservative or more conservative about gender roles than older generations. On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at women's rights in the Arab world. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a great panel of experts. But first, we're going to talk to Liz Sly, a Middle East reporter for The Washington Post. She recently wrote a lengthy article about women's lives in Saudi Arabia, and she joins us now from Beirut, Lebanon. Liz, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. So Saudi Arabia, of course, is known for being the most restrictive, conservative place in the region for women. So let's just start with this issue about driving. Why do you see that the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, decided to lift the ban on women driving?
Well, I think there are two things going on here. First of all, as you said, Saudi Arabia is the most restrictive country for women in the world. There is nowhere that it is harder to be a woman than Saudi Arabia. And the biggest public symbol of that was the driving. It's the only place where women aren't allowed to drive. And above all, the reason is economic, because the Crown Prince has realized that he's got to take the country into a post-oil era. At some point, Saudi Arabia won't be able to depend on oil earnings as it does today. And to improve the economy, you have to get women into the workplace to replace the many foreign workers that they have there doing a lot of the jobs that women might otherwise do in other countries. And if you're going to get women into the workplace, you've got to get them, or they've got to be able to get to work, so you've got to be able to allow them to drive. And more broadly, I think he's very concerned to improve the image of Saudi Arabia. And whenever you ask anybody in the world, they might not know much about Saudi Arabia, but they do know it's the country where women aren't allowed to drive, and that lifting this restriction, I think he feels, will go a long way towards improving Saudi Arabia's image, encouraging foreigners to go there, and generally removing some of the negativity associated with the country.
So it sounds like two issues. One was economic, one was more about changing the country's image. But when you traveled there, you wrote about how Saudi women, just in ordinary life, face like a series of complicated calculations every day about things like when to remove their headscarf and what door to use when entering a building, things like this. And if they get it wrong, they can face harassment or be humiliated. Can you just paint us a picture of how you saw that?
Yes, it's really quite hard to kind of convey how restrictive life is for women in Saudi Arabia. There are just so many rules and regulations. As you said, which door you go into. For example, I'm a Westerner. I'm there. I see a Starbucks. Starbucks is my culture. I am familiar with Starbucks. I see a Starbucks. I walk towards the Starbucks. I think, oh, great, I'll get a coffee. I always walk in the front door. The front door is for men only. Women have to use the side door or often a back entrance. This is just normal to people in Saudi Arabia. To me, it's not normal. Saudi women cover their faces, they cover their hair, they wear long black garments. Almost all of them continue to wear that. They will remove the headscarf at a certain point in their social lives, perhaps when they're indoors, but do they know the man well enough to remove their face cover? Do they know the man well enough to remove their head cover? All of these things is a constant set of calculations. Now, the biggest change is not that these calculations have necessarily changed, but the government has stopped enforcing some of them. So what you're seeing is the state retreat from controlling the lives of women as much as it was before. There are now officially supposed to be no penalties for women who don't cover their hair, for example. But in reality, the conservative traditions still exist. The family exerts a great deal of influence. A lot of families are not going to let their women drive, for example, or are not going to let their women take advantage of more relaxed dress codes. And so although a lot is changing on the one hand, on the other hand, not that much is changing.
Well, talk to us, if you would, what role did women's groups or activists have in bringing some of these changes about? Was this sort of like a grassroots-led initiative?
Well, really not at all, unfortunately. There have been some very brave women over the years, and it started in 1990, who have taken to the roads to try and demand the right to drive. They've campaigned for the right to drive. They have been silenced and locked up. And in one of the sadder things about this change, there are now at least 9, maybe 10 women activists in prison because they had demanded the right to drive. Now, it seems really contradictory to jail women for demanding the right to drive while giving women the right to drive. But the message is really very, very clear. Social reforms are to be allowed, but at the request, at the behest of the government. Only the government can give you a freedom. You can't claim one for yourself. You can't demand one. And they are making it very clear that these reforms are not to be accompanied by political reforms or political freedoms.
So it seems like women are gaining some rights in spite of the fact that the country as a whole is not gaining democratically then. It's sort of like state-led feminism in a way.
Yes, you could call it state-led feminism. Exactly. The Crown Prince has decided he wants to improve the image of Saudi Arabia. So he's decreeing various measures that will reduce the restrictions on women. But there is one key restriction that remains, and all the women I spoke to said they wanted this to be lifted. They all cited it as the biggest impediment in their lives, and the women activists had been demanding it, and they might well have been locked up as well to stop them demanding it any longer, which is the guardianship law. Now, the guardianship law means that women basically can't do a lot with their lives without the permission of a male relative. They have to get the male relative's permission to travel abroad, to go to university, to take jobs, to open a bank account. And the guardianship law remains intact, and there isn't actually any sign that they're planning on changing that.
And so our time does grow short, but if you could, how do you see things changing over the next couple of years? You said the guardianship law doesn't seem likely to be changed. Is this, you know, is the driving, ending the driving ban, was that just sort of like a first step and that we're going to see a slow progression of changes? Or do you think, like, that's it now?
It's really hard to tell. There's still a lot of very conservative people who really don't want these changes and are working against them. There was a woman chased out of Saudi Arabia yesterday for wearing slightly too revealing clothing, for wearing a white abaya during the news coverage of the Saudi women driving, and she's had to leave the country for her own life. I think there could be a conservative backlash to these changes. On the other hand, the women are so enthusiastic.
So sorry, that's for wearing a white cloak instead of a black cloak.
Yes. And the abaya was like open so that you could see her clothes underneath. It was nowhere near revealing by Western standards, but by Saudi standards, obviously, some people were very angry about that because women wear black and they completely closed the abaya gown around them. Conservatives who are very, very angry about these changes. There could be a backlash. You never know who's going to survive in the leadership of Saudi Arabia and whether that could undergo a change. But one of the things I noticed there was that the women themselves are totally enthusiastic about the changes. Even the most conservative women who don't really particularly want to uncover their faces or their hair or anything, they want to work, they want to drive, they want that freedom of independence and independence to be able to make a difference with their own lives. And whether they would ever tolerate having these reforms rolled back in any way at all, I don't know. And of course, it's always interesting to see when you open the door a little whether it's ever possible to close it again and whether the pressure of popular support will push it open even wider.
Well, Liz Sly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about recent reforms aimed at improving the lives of women in the Arab world. But there has been some recent progress. The region still often ranks as the worst in the world on measures of women's rights. Now, to broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in three other people who have been closely following changes in the region. Joining us now from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, is Gabriela Nassif. She's a research consultant with the Institute for Women's Studies in the Arab World at the Lebanese American University. And on the line from Washington, D.C. is Nafisa Saeed. Nafisa is a journalist and co-author of the 2014 book, Arab Women Rising, about female entrepreneurs. Also with us in Boston is Valentin Mogadam. Born in Iran, Valentin is a professor of sociology and international affairs at Northeastern University. She's also the author of the book Modernizing Women, Gender, and Social Change in the Middle East. Welcome to all of you. Valentin, let me start with you. We heard just a few moments ago about some positive changes for women in Saudi Arabia. What about the Arab region as a whole over the last couple of years? Just briefly, do you see things improving generally or not so much?
Well, Saudi Arabia is quite the laggard when it comes to women's rights. I'm very pleased that they are now allowed to drive, but they are decades behind other Arab women. In North Africa in particular, we have had decades of, you know, what some scholars have called state feminism, whereby governments have actually been rather supportive of women's participation and rights. And this was certainly the case in Tunisia, where from the 1950s, women won a very liberal and fairly egalitarian family law. And, you know, gradually over the decades, they made quite a number of advances in terms of employment, political participation, education, and actually the formation of women's organizations. So there are variations across the region in terms of women's participation and rights, their legal status, their social positions, and so on. But there are some difficulties and some problems, yeah.
We'll touch on those in just a moment, but I want to turn this to Nafisa Saeed. You know, one of the things that you have done as a reporter is that you had traveled to interview refugee women, I believe refugees from the Yemeni war in Djibouti and also refugees from the Syrian war in Jordan. Talk to us just a little bit about how the wars in Syria and Yemen affected sort of the role of women, the lives of women there.
You had women who were really at the forefront in when, you know, these countries were having uprisings and overthrowing longtime dictators. So women sort of were part of that process and wanted to be part of the political transition, which we can talk more about. But obviously, because of the circumstances of war, whether the civil war in Syria, the Saudi-backed, the Saudi-led coalition fighting in Yemen. And so that's left a lot of women having to really become, you know, at the forefront of leading their families and households, becoming breadwinners. I talk to a lot of women, and you're seeing them, especially within Yemen, having to break some social taboos around the kind of work they do, and having to negotiate new spaces in which they're becoming involved. And so that's really changed the landscape, because you have so many men either on the front lines or being killed. And the same goes for Syrians, especially we see this in refugee populations. Women are really the ones holding families together and really having to feed their families, if nothing else.
Well, Gabriela Nassif, you're in Beirut, which I believe Lebanon has something like 1.5 million Syrian war refugees in a country that was previously only, I think the population was around 4 to 5 million. Just talk to us a little bit about how norms for Syrian women and girls have been changed by the refugee experience. Nafisa was talking about some sort of positive changes in their gender roles.
To be completely honest, I mean, I think we see both, right? We definitely see an increase in responsibility for women to kind of abandon their normative gender roles, right, that might keep them in households, that might keep them outside of the workforce, because aid is just not enough to supply these families with what they need. So we do see women moving outside of the household and participating in ways that they might not have had either the opportunity to or just weren't necessarily under the pressure to do so back in Syria. However, of course, as Nafisa just mentioned, in any refugee setting, women and girls unfortunately bear a very heavy burden when it comes to issues such as protection, So especially when family networks break down, we see girls and women either separated from large family networks that often provided security. We see women and girls under heavier supervision from male guardians, basically out of fear, you know, fear for their safety, fear that, you know, they're not really aware of the landscape. And so we see a little bit of both, right? And I guess, unfortunately, it goes without saying that gender-based violence is exacerbated, especially, you know, in an emergency and in a place like Lebanon, where, you know, Syrian refugees continue to come across the border. And we are just completely under-equipped to deal with a number of refugees, and especially women and girls, that need very specific.
Well, I understand one of the consequences in Lebanon was that you had was actually a problem of child marriage, and that Syrian refugees were in such desperate straits that one of the best ways they saw that they could sort of increase their economic opportunity was to marry off a daughter, even if she was quite young.
Yeah, absolutely. And there have been a number of studies that have been done on this. And overwhelmingly, the same kind of results keep appearing, which is that there is just very limited options for ensuring a stronger livelihood support once they are in a refugee setting, especially in Lebanon. And so many of these families thought, exactly as you said, that yes, this is the best option. And, you know, there are many things that people we don't commonly think about that are, you know, a result of gender, that women and girls need privacy, and that in these informal settlements, because as you know, Lebanon has not opened up formal refugee camps for Syrians, protections for these girls walking around outside, most of these normative behaviors actually have a much higher risk. And so that getting married sometimes means the benefit of having a private living situation. So we think about that. We have to think about these things all the time and remember that these are instances of gender-based violence in a way that, you know, it has to do with an economic stability that many of these women and girls just don't have here.
Well, Valentin, Gabriella was touching on this phenomenon. I guess it's related to this guardianship idea. And we talked about the guardianship law in Saudi Arabia, where male relatives basically are legally given sort of supervisory status over women. Do women elsewhere in the region, do they face this same sort of guardianship issue?
Yes, in most countries they do, but in North Africa that's been changing. Certainly in Tunisia, that doesn't exist anymore, nor in Morocco since the reform of the family law in 2004. You know, this is part of the variations within the region that, you know.
And so, sorry, just to clarify, this means like if you want to get a job, if you want to take a class, right, if you want to get married, you would normally, traditionally, have had to get the permission of your father or a male relative.
Father, husband, brother, or some other male relative. Yes, that's the male guardianship over women and also of children. It also means that in the event of divorce, for example, custody of the children, you know, reverts to the father, especially after, you know, puberty. But that's not the case in Tunisia. That's no longer the case in Morocco. Algerian women's organizations have been advocating to end the system of tutelle, as they call it in French, the guardianship in Algeria. They're also calling for the sweeping reforms and changes in family law their sisters in Tunisia and Morocco enjoy, which also means an end to polygamy as well.
And Nafisa Saeed, let me turn the conversation to you then. One of the things that you've talked about that I think is sort of a common thread through discussions about women's rights in the Arab world, in the Middle East, is that it's often viewed as being sort of a Western or, you know, even potentially sort of corrupt idea or ideology, and that it's not compatible with traditional values or with traditional Islam. Talk to us just a little bit about that. Is that still the case?
I think that's something in my reporting I've always tried to do, is ask women how they define what it is, does it mean to have rights, what is women's rights, what is it that they are looking for. You know, I remember this little anecdote, a woman in Yemen telling me, look, you know, we're not looking to take our hijabs or headscarves off, we just are interested in having more participation in the public sphere, for instance. And so that's just like a very little example of, you know, women wanting to help define what they're carving out their spaces. And so I think, you know, it's interesting to see in places like Tunisia or others where you are seeing some more kind of discussion overlap, whether it's with people who are from Islamist parties and women from more secular kind of orientation coming together and maybe talking about some common goals that they could have perhaps. And I've always asked women, how do you define rights? What is it that you would like to see in your society? And then also there's, you know, some new initiatives and understanding in what role religion plays and how they see religion helping or hurting, you know, kind of what it is that they would like to obtain. There's actually a initiative at Columbia University looking at sort of the framing of gender-based violence interventions from Western and international institutions, especially in the Middle East, And I think there you have academics and journalists and people who work in NGOs coming together and trying to understand more, what does that mean when organizations from overseas come in and sort of presume that religion is the reason that, you know, is all everything is backward, but actually looking at how there are a lot of initiatives happening within these countries led by women from these countries, and they'll talk about how they have to, say, talk to religious clerics or authorities in trying to bring about the change, or maybe like we were talking about inheritance laws in Tunisia, and trying to, you know, be able to bring about that change. They have to have that dialogue. And so I think that's an interesting development to keep track of. And then as well, you know, how women are also trying to define what it is that they're interested in and what they would like to obtain as well. So not just looking at it, yes, there are people that will look at sort of foreign interventions as, you know, not really being in line with what their values are, but there are movements and other initiatives going on that we also need to think about in how women themselves are defining this.
Well, Gabrielle and Asif, if I could just shift gears for a moment, you are in Lebanon, which is one of the more liberal countries in the Arab world. When it comes to political participation, I think until recently, there were only 4 women in a parliament of 120-some lawmakers. So talk to us, if you would, about sort of women's role in politics in the public sphere. Do we see progress there? Is there reason for optimism?
I mean, there's always a reason for optimism, yes, but this was, so we actually had nearly 113 women candidates running this time. And while that was extremely exciting, and especially coming from civil society, we were thrilled to see these numbers turn out. Of course, in Lebanon, we toe this very fine line between progressive at first sight and, you know, our deep-seated values kind of inhibit women from actually occupying positions with decision-making capability, right? So over the past couple of years, we've actually been debating whether or not to instate a quota system, which, you know, as you know, means having a certain percentage of women actually occupy parliamentary seats. And while there are definitely pros and cons, which I won't get into, to having a quota system, for many of us, it's still the idea that we need to just get women, like you said, we need to get more than 4 women into the parliament. But so you can see, I mean, women were quite active.
And I'm sorry, so you had mentioned that there were something like 100 candidates in the parliamentary elections this year, but actually very few of them won.
Right. So there were, I think, like 113 women candidates, and very few won, yes. And I believe there was only one that won a seat out of the civil society campaign, which made the explicit effort to not be affiliated with any of the normal political powerhouses in the Lebanese political landscape. So again, while we are really excited with these, with that progress, you know, we'll take anything we can get. But at the same time, just to give you an example, you know, prior to the parliamentary elections, there were legal debates going on, and there had been 3 actual draft laws submitted to the parliament on the issue of a minimum age of marriage across all of the different sects in Lebanon, so all the different religious courts. And, you know, the parliamentary elections unfortunately just stopped all of that advocacy, all of that mobilization in its tracks. And so now we can only hope that, you know, now that things, we're waiting for this new government to kind of settle in, that this advocacy work will start up again. And we're hoping we can depend on some of these women who are now in parliament to support these efforts as well. So there is hope, but again, I think as everybody on this panel has said, it's just very small steps. So we're just going to have to keep pushing.
And Valentin Mogadam, we heard about sort of some of the political, the issues with women's progress in the political sphere, at least in Lebanon. What about on the economic side? Do you see that there is significant progress being made there? You know, we understand that this issue of inheritance and women not having equal inheritance rights, not being able to inherit property from their husbands, from their parents, has been a very sort of controversial issue in a number of countries. How do you see that playing out?
Right, and that is one of the deficits in women's rights. In Tunisia today, the president has actually lent his support for equal inheritance rights for women. Yeah, you know, I've long written about the economic and financial implications of unequal inheritance, especially at a time when women's entrepreneurship and self-employment is really, you know, becoming part of the national and international discourse. When women have a smaller share of family wealth, and given that a lot of startup businesses begin with family wealth, Well, that puts women at a disadvantage. And so obviously that might be one reason why there is such a smaller proportion of women owned businesses in various countries in the region. One other deficit that women suffer from in the region is low levels of female labor force participation and employment. Married women in particular have very weak labor force attachment, which means that they might enter the labor force as single women. They may stay there after they're married, but once they have children, they drop out, and they may drop out permanently as well. Now, this happened in Western countries too, but Western countries took some steps to end this. And in part, they instituted rather generous paid maternity leaves, not the United States, but most European countries, and by the way, a lot of developing countries. And the other thing that really makes a difference for women, especially women from lower income and working class families, and that is preschool and childcare facilities. You know, upper income women, professional women, highly educated women can afford nannies at home, but working class women cannot. And this is precisely why the largest proportion of women in the labor forces in countries of the Middle East and North Africa actually are educated middle class women. So we have this missing middle, so to speak. Women with secondary schooling or below are really missing from the labor force in many countries. And I believe it has a great deal to do with the absence of generous maternity leave and certainly preschool facilities and quality and affordable childcare. I mean, this in a region where, you know, family really matters and children matter. So this is absolutely necessary. Can I make one point going back to the politics?
Yeah, please.
I think it's really important to understand that women's movements in the region are entirely indigenous. They have not been influenced by, you know, so-called Western feminism. And in any event, there are different varieties of Western feminism. I mean, what exists in the United States is very different from, for example, Scandinavia, where women's social rights are much more pronounced and emphasized. But in the Middle East as well, many of the initial founders and pioneers of women's rights organizations in the 1970s, they came out of left-wing movements and organizations in their own countries. They were initially very much influenced by socialist ideology. And then with the formation of all these, the emergence of these series of United Nations conferences on women, they were able to attend those conferences, and then they were able to interact with, engage with women and feminists and advocates from all over the world, including other parts of Africa, Asia, Latin America, and so on and so forth. And so that helped to, you know, shape their sense of, you know, what is absolutely needed. And going back to their own countries, you know, I've been studying women's movements and organizations since the 1990s, and I noticed at the time, and this is still the case, that their priorities are around these four main issues. Reform of the family law, and in most countries, in almost all countries, family law is very, very patriarchal, with this guardianship, male control over women, and women's subordination within the family, and so on. Equal nationality rights for women, ending violence against women. I mean, honor crimes, for example, that constituted a very big campaign in the 1990s and into the new century. And last but not least is increasing women's political representation. And they've managed to do that with quotas, in particular in Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Liz Sly, Gabriella Nassif, Valentin Mogadam, and Nafisa Saeed. Our producers this week are Rosie Belson and Yanqi Su. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.